This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 11th of December, 1952. The title of this lecture is Chart of Attitudes, Rising Scale Processing. This lecture is 65 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Thank you.
This is the first evening lecture of December the 11th. I'm going to cover rapidly now the chart of attitudes with all of its various facets. You've read this chart of attitudes. You found it in the Handbook for Pre-Clears. And in the Handbook for Pre-Clears, it talks about it as an ideal state of mind. I don't think there's any real contest with it being an ideal state for man, but if you took the whole top band, you'd find it was an awfully inactive state. If you didn't go on from the top of the messed universe band into some sort of activity or something of the sort, you'd have no being. That activity is yours. Now, the odd part of all this is that your activity is, in this universe, is enforced or inhibited. You're given the supplies and then, to a large degree, not permitted to use them. And your own process, your own manufacture, mock-ups, and so forth, is actually in contest with the messed universe. The messed universe says, look how big and strong and real I am, and how weak and puny you are. How does it say that? It says, my actuality is brighter than any you can make. This doesn't happen to be true. The reality of the messed universe is poorer than a reality which a pre-clear can gain in his own universe. This would only be natural because what is one's own can be more real than that which one has given to him. One always appreciates that of which he is the author more than he appreciates something of which he is not the author. This is rather inevitable sort of thing. And so, really here, following out this whole process of Scientology 8008, we find we are working with really a curve that goes two ways here. Starts down from here at 00 and then goes up here at 40 and comes over here and comes down here again. And this could be the messed universe, and this could be your own universe. One of the reasons universities get patronized is because they use the word university. One of the reasons they get loyalty from their students is because they use the word university and your university. There really is no other reason. That's right. Platley. Let's look at facts of the case. The writer, would-be writer, goes to a university to write. If he's taught, unquote, to write in a university, he'll never write. A painter goes there to learn how to paint, and he comes out, he never paints. Fascinating fact. That's because he runs into authoritarianism. It does something to one's will to be positioned for such long a period of time as from the age of 5 to the age of 22, 23, or 24. A person is young, he can stand it up to about the age of 15, 16, 17. Then he starts to suffer badly by being positioned. If he does not take on the responsibilities of his own existence shortly after puberty,
he is going to have a hard time of it the rest of his life. And that is the flat end of it. It is no joke that university women do not have children. That's a fact. They don't. They don't reproduce that particular line to any great degree. There are a lot of them that do. And the funny part of it is, these days they're breaking out of that rut somewhat. Somewhat. But the GI Bill didn't do anything for this. Look at Heidelberg. European university is a very interesting one. Sometimes you even go to class. The GI Bill was a whip over the heads of anybody who wished to study, the like of which nobody's ever seen. You had to have a high average to keep up. This was one of the ways the government used to keep everybody from benefiting by it. You had to have a high whip. Average, big average. Bang. You had to get in there and know those facts. And instruction under those conditions was what? As many as 400 students to a class with one instructor. And that instructor was just a lecturer. No instruction, really. Very interesting. I looked at universities. So this is going on. There's one thing that saved the bacon of the GI. He'd been out on his own somewhat, and he'd also found out how to duck and dodge in the service. It's the only thing he had. But if I have to rehabilitate or try to rehabilitate one more writer that a university has ruined, I'm going to go over and really fix me up some short story professors. I'm going to zap them so they'll know they've been zapped. Because I'm sick of it. I run the same old yap. The kid turns in a good idea, a piece of his own universe, and he gets it back. The punctuation is off. Who the hell cares about the punctuation? That's what you have editors for. What do they teach these kids? They teach them how to edit. Some of the most famous writers in America were congregated in one room. These writers were looking for somebody who had a PhD in literature, a doctorate in literature, or something in literature, that we didn't even know what the degree was. And everybody kind of squirmed. One fellow says, well, fact of the matter is I took engineering. I didn't take writing. And another one says, well, I only spent the first year in college, and then they kicked me out. Another fellow says, you did? Well, I was there 2 years before they kicked me out. All of a sudden, we look through this whole crowd, and we find out, my God, everybody here has been kicked out of a university and probably didn't spend very long there, except maybe if they were taking engineering, and then they were hanging around to the fringes, and then the only reason the university graduated them as engineers, they knew damn well he'd never practiced engineering. And that was about all we had, except one little small proud voice piped up over in the corner, and he said, I have a degree in literature. We thought, for Christ's sakes, mice? It was what? It was a literary agent. I mean, oh no. Flesh brokers. They can't write. Oh, how they'd love to. He was the only one there. The aggregate income of that room, by the way, was in excess of $150,000 a month. Except the literary agent. He did criticisms for $1 a manuscript. Isn't this fascinating? Something must be off the rails if a country does not turn itself out aesthetics. There were 280,000 bachelors of art graduated in 1947 from the United States. 280,000. My God, think what would have happened if you'd graduated into this country 280,000 good artists. The whole face of the United States would have changed. Now, there are things that can be taught, but not the arts. You can teach them engineering,
You can teach them something that has any process or procedure. You can get them together and teach them government. You can teach law. You can do a lot of these things. But you can't teach the arts. And there's where I get the index. How much better could they work? Well, they could work better if they stayed true to their own pretense that they're a university. If one went to his own university and if it treated him like that, he would have the right to think. And he'd have the right to have an opinion. And he'd have the right to make up his own mind. And he would be there so that information could be made available to him so he could figure it out. And this problem right here would have been licked hundreds and hundreds of years ago if it hadn't been for the scholastics and if it hadn't have been for the modern university. You owe him a great debt, a debt of continued slavery, because they pretended they were responsible for this problem, and they never took responsibility for it. So you'll get all sorts of kickbacks as you go the outside of that propaganda. Understand, I'm not trying to destroy the American university as an institution. I think we've got to have football, and the more football we have, the better. Anyway, they... whole idea here is to restore freedom of action, freedom of thought, freedom to believe, freedom to survive, freedom to know, freedom to be responsible, freedom to create motion, freedom to be faith, not have to have it, freedom to win. Very interesting. Those are freedoms. And funny thing, a man has to be free in order to be those things. And as soon as he starts being owned, he ceases to have them. And one of the first steps is to tell him how nice it is to be owned. We'll take full responsibility for you. You know, in the Roman Empire, that the consuls and so forth were often proconsuls. Kids around town. The kids around town, the kind that you see maybe going to a Boy Scout troop or something like that in this society. How you defeat an abundance of labor. The kids around town, the richer families, the so on, the more noteworthy children, took on the duties of office at 12, 13, and 14. And most of the famous characters that you read about in Roman history, you're reading about periods of their lives from 15 to 20. That's when the body is growing, it's vital, it's progressive, and it doesn't know the word stop. It doesn't learn that till it's about 30. By that time, it's got it.
Good.
Now, when you look over all of this, the second that a man says, I have to have some other force than mine own, he ceases to be free. An interchange of knowledge can occur, but an interchange and borrowing of force cannot. A state and a people have no business operating on a police basis. I should never, but this is a beautiful police universe. Police, 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 every direction you look. Regimentation and policing. Very wicked. Because people are persuaded to turn over their individual force to something that they are given to understand is superior to their own ability to protect. And that can never be. That's a snare. That can never be. Nobody will look after a man's own but himself. And nobody will look after the property of a group but itself. But if you do that sort of thing, you are proposing anarchy. You're proposing that you do not have a government by force. But you're proposing that anybody be given license in the field of Fort Maine. Oh, no, that part, unfortunately, isn't workable either. Unless one has achieved at the same time a level of ethic permissible to have such force in existence. Fortunately, Nobody ever had the adventure or the information to look at it before and find out. Did one's ethic increase to the degree that he was free above a certain point? No, they looked at a rabble that had always been nailed down, chained down, hang dog, maul rolled under have-nots, that would suddenly spring free, crawl out of the gutters and sewers, and by negative-positive reaction, hit a country, tear it to pieces, throw it back down the time track in havingness 1,000, 2,000 years, the French Revolution. And then they say, look what happens when you give them freedom. That's a good reason now why we should use force. It was force and the suppression of force which caused that action. It wasn't the other. A man's freedom then cannot be a halfway thing. You cannot compromise or quibble with the freedom of a man. If there is a perfect form of government, that form of government would be anarchy. Everybody has agreed to this. An anarchy, however, would have to be built out of individuals who were capable, each one, of complete self-government. An impossible condition in the past. If each person were capable of complete self-government and capable of taking responsibility utterly for his own acts, you would have, for the first time, a basis of ethic. And the other way around, you only have a moral. And a moral code is no good. An ethical code can be depended upon. Because if you have an ethical code, you only have it as long as it exists. And it exists only as long as a man has enough strength not to himself be afraid. Anytime he is susceptible to terror, you're going to lose your ethic. The only time a man gets afraid is when he loses his belief in himself and his trust in himself. And every criminal you find in an institution went on the road to crime in one direction only and at one moment only, when he lost his own self-respect. You can go check that. You'll find out that that is uniformly the case. If you want to rehabilitate the criminal, rehabilitate his self-respect. One day he suddenly found out he couldn't trust himself anymore, and from that moment on he became a criminal, because it did not matter now what he did. And in a gradient scale, you have a modern society. Now, what then is your level that is an attainable level for freedom? It would have to be a level which is so high that every man could reason and be responsible in his own right for his own acts, and also for the acts of others. Blame, regret is the course of a police state. And his spiral dwindles down and dwindles very rapidly. So there's no halfway point on this scale. You can't cut it off here and say we've done a good job and reformed the whole world. You can't cut it off here at A. You can't cut it off at B. You just got to go ahead and put the guy into shape so he can handle himself and his force. You can patch up somebody and make him well. That's what you were straining against in auditing. You see, you broke agreement with the first book. You broke agreement with the Mist Universe to this degree, to about 4.0. You said, look, it says I have to have engrams and I have to have things that force me to do various things. And look, I can run them out. As fast as they happen, bad things happen to me, I can run them out. You were disagreeing with the mandates of the physical universe to that extent. But that extent ceases at 4.0, and from there on up, it requires another process. That's why, immediately, Homo sapiens can go to 4.0 on Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health, and the Science of Survival, but he can't go anyplace above that without having his self-determinism restored to him. He becomes well, he becomes better able to reason, but I have not seen what I had hoped to see, because unfortunately, it can't exist, an ethical, strong Homo sapiens. And if it can't exist, let's go up here. Gee, you're clear up to about a potential of 36, 38, before you can get a full level susceptible to good ethic. An ethic is that which is enforced by oneself, his belief in his own honor, and good reason, an optimum solution along the eight dynamics. That's ethics. And morals is somebody who sticks a spear into your belly or a sepulcher over your head, hides a boogeyman back of a chair, tells you nothing, and says you've got to do it because the unseen gods. There's no difference between a taboo and a moral. This language is even beginning to go to pieces, because in the dictionaries of today, unlike the dictionaries of just 100 years ago, a moral is defined as an ethic, and an ethic is defined as a moral in the modern dictionary. Oh, they've even lost the philosophic definition for an ethic. You don't think he's bad off, he's bad off. Homo sapiens at 4.0 is a lot better than Homo sapiens has ever been. But Homo sapiens at 4.0, compared to a level which you would desirable ethical, it has to measure up to the potentialities of the being. And at 4.0, he is much, much, much less than 100,000th of his proper horsepower. And it's too fine and too small a strength to be able to stand up to the winds of the world and the howling of yells of all the fears of the universe. It's too much. That strength out there, in here, it's too cold for Homo sapiens, or it's too hot, or it's too scarce. He can be killed too easily. As a consequence, this big, blustering universe can look at him and say, "You don't dare be ethical. You're afraid." And so he is. He's afraid. Now, when you get into knowingness then, and when you get into an allowable band, these here survive right, full responsible. Do you know that a man really doesn't dare be right? What would happen if you went out determined to be right for 24 hours? What would it mean that you'd have to be right every time that you said anything, did anything, mentioned anything? You couldn't be polite. You'd have to say what you meant. Huh, you'd be shot in your tracks before you got out of here. Typical behavior of Homo sapiens. Two elevators in the hotel are both sticking this morning. Girl gets on. She fusses all the way down. She's fussing, damning, oh, cursing around terribly because one of these elevators is sticking. Both of them are, really, and misses floors and all that sort of thing. She's going to really give the management a piece of her mind. And she walks over to the desk, and she picks up her morning mail, and she says to this little, tiny, meek clerk, she said, "I suppose you're fixing the elevators." And the clerk said, "Yes," and she dropped it at that. Real brave, Homo sapiens, real brave. He knows it doesn't do any good. But let's ask the same question. What the hell is this girl doing needing an elevator? So, this is a rough universe. You'd have to be able to handle the majority of forces in it before you could stand up to it and never be afraid. Or you would have to hold inside yourself a piece of courage that would be strained and tortured beyond all belief in an effort to be courageous enough to take this universe. I believe the people who are alive today are by far the more courageous ones, because this universe really dishes the boys in who aren't. Now we've got here two tracks, and we might as well split them off into two tone scales. We'll draw this line down here, YZ. We'll show the difference between these two things just by dividing it. But I don't know what the scale over here will be. I haven't got any idea, because that's all up to you. This scale might start here something like 40, where you made space, but you always had to have an object before you made a space, which might put 40 there. or both of those might be 40 for you, or you might have 0, 0 here. And as you went up and got too much space in your universe, you might go into -8 as a penalty. You might have a little square that when you move on to this, you go back 8 steps. I don't know what's on this side. That's your universe, and I haven't got any idea what being that or how you figure things out. I do know this, however, that it would be very interesting. But over here on the mess universe side, you bet your life I know what's over here. 0, 0, 20, 0. It's taken me 25 years to find out what's over there. Wasn't that it was a tough problem. It's too incredibly simple. You always kept overshooting its complexity. Always kept overshooting it. The secret of the mesh universe was there was no secret. So, we get here, and we come up the line. Well, theoretically, a person would go from this point over here, this point N, and he'd go up here where this parabola, or whatever it is, hits this YZ line. This would be area T for transit. And as a person's tone rose, his freedom would rise, and he'd go up to that area according to graph. Fortunately, you don't really go according to graphs, you see. You theoretically go up and go through that area and down this side again. That isn't possible. Because, you see, it isn't possible to transit at the top there because it's a what? You wouldn't be able to tell where the space started and ended that was your universe and mesh universe, and you could get very, very mixed up about space up there at that point T. And therefore, time would go screwy and so on. So what you're doing is an entirely different operation. You're actually postulating a 0, 0 in your universe, and you're doing mock-ups in your universe at first comparable to or less than the stability of mock-ups in this universe. So you're doing a jump here for the left-hand side of the curve, the right-hand side of the curve. See? On the physical universe curve, you're doing things over here on the own universe curve which are comparable. You're doing the same comparability. You're not building a universe. You're just practicing over here on your own universe curve. What do you know? Several people say, funny thing is happening, but the mess universe doesn't seem to be getting any more real. It's unreal, a lot of things I run in it, but you know those things I mock up? Boy, are they getting real. They really look good, and so forth. I'd sure hate to get rid of that. I sure hated to get rid of that. That was real nice. That sort of thing, picking up more and more and more and more and more. Of course, when one is able to do that all the way over, he can actually flash back onto this side, and if he's gotten himself parked here, 20-0, 20-0, supposing he's 20-0 on this mock curve, this own universe curve. You see, you're not building your own universe. That's just its curve. That's just a practice curve. So if you're opposite 20-0 on the mess universe curve, and you're 20-0 over on this side, what are you going to get? It's very fascinating that you would probably be able to rig up a blonde in an evening gown down on the street, and men would come by and they'd say, gee, tip their hats. That's theoretically. So what would happen? You get way up into form of action, you'd be able to interchange images. But that's just a practice curve. So what's the curve of your own universe? All right, it'd be another curve over here, and I don't care how it goes. Torsional G space, for all I know. But when you're all up the line and so on, why, you're up there. Well before you get to that point T, well before you get to T, you should be able to throw things up which at least to you are superior, vastly superior in quality, depth, intricacy, design, and interest, far superior to messed universe. And in view of the fact that you're doing this as a thetan, most any time you could part company with a body. I mean, you've got reality on that, a lot of you. But at the end of 3 weeks, you certainly better have better than just a little reality on it. You better be out. Clear. There isn't any reason why you can't be. I haven't seen a hard case in this whole class. All right. You're doing a comparative level. Well, now, these concepts, which are here on the chart of attitudes, don't tell you anything about the quality of a mock-up, except in a highly generalized way. But they tell you, when you say, chart of attitudes, messed universe, that gives you an ideal state of being, or a man, or something of the sort. And over on your own universe, the mock curve, practice mock curve, what you're trying to attain in a mock-up is the following. You want it to be able to survive. It should be right. It should take full responsibility for what it's doing. And you take full responsibility for it. You should be able to own all. You should be able to make anything that approximates anything. You should be able to make it continue on an always basis, or have always there, in other words, all kinds of time. You should have things which are motion sources in there. The level of truth of that universe ought to be good. If you would be faith in that universe, or your mock-ups, as far as faith is concerned, you would probably rely on a mock-up a heck of a lot quicker than you'd ever rely on a piece of mess. I mean that seriously. You'd just rely on the mock-up. That's not bad. If you can create a Cadillac, which can outrun Cadillacs, I think you'd depend upon your Cadillac. Get the idea? But if you were really up the top of the mock-up curve, you've made a Cadillac, you would drive your Cadillac much in preference to a Cadillac. You get the idea. Sounds strange, sounds peculiar, but if you were doing that and you really set out to make a Cadillac, yours would be a better Cadillac. For you. Actually, you think a messed universe is good? No. Takes gas, it's scarce, costs money. Now, the level of knowingness. You would know what the beingness and other things were of this universe. Your universe, your mock-up. There's a knowingness about your mock-up. You can make a mock-up that knows, or you would know everything that was about the mock-up. And as far as knowledge was concerned, you would have the knowledge down pat that required. There'd be a knowingness, a feeling of knowing about these things. You would be cause, you wouldn't be effect. Or you could make a mock-up that was cause for a lot of things. You would have reached I am, full beingness, and you would be able to win. The easiest way to win is to be both sides. You'd be able to start things, terrific differentiation, very good state of being. You'd be able to make all the space you wanted. So forth. That's just your goals of identity or identification or individuality of your mock-ups and their character and quality. I know it sounds terribly upsetting to you when I say something like Cadillac. Actually, you'd probably never mock up a Cadillac. Anybody who wants to go around and mock up a Cadillac and then drive it, of course, would finally find himself faced with the fact that he didn't have license tags on the thing. It's not a practical solution. You'd have to put motor numbers on it, serial numbers, and persuade somebody in the Cadillac company that they built it. You get how the universe works a guy in? Well, heck, you wouldn't want to do that then. Unless you built a Cadillac which had the potentialities of a General Sherman tank, and which, of course, had bulletproof windows, had a turret gun in the top of the thing, and which would go down the road at 180 miles an hour. Then it'd be perfectly safe to own that Cadillac and so forth with no license plates, no serial number. You're building in contests, you've got to build senior, too. That's always a good process. Now, the funny part of this universe is when you've mocked something up way back on the track, so you've had terrific experience with this. It's just lost because you kept putting them into competition with the messed universe and then agreeing with the messed universe. Then you put this thing into competition and you'd mock up this girl. You didn't have much experience, so you didn't know what a girl should look like. And the messed universe had come along. You thought it was the messed universe. Some of the thing come along. Beautiful mock-up of a girl. Oh, lovely. Oh, gee. And you go,
boy, that's really something. And this thing of mine, nah. And then there's a certain sort of feeling about something you haven't made yourself, too. It furnishes interest. You have to have something somebody else has. And a lot of idiocy in this because you wasn't educated, fella. You was ignorant. In fact, you was stupid. You talk about the gullibility of an early track thetan. We've never mentioned this before because he's in a state of capability of knowingness. He didn't have any data. Oh, boy, was he stupid. Somebody come around to him and say, you just won a contest. And he says, I did. Well, now, fortunately, you don't have to keep an education in terms of facsimiles. You can just park it as knowingness. In Science of Survival, we had something about theta interpolates with mast and then frees itself from mast with a knowingness of what mast is. That's in Science of Survival. It impinges itself too heavily upon mast and then withdraws. And then it'll impinge itself and withdraw and impinge itself and withdraw. And that cycle goes down until it knows all there is to know about mess. Well, we don't know all there is to know about mess, but you don't have to know all there is about mess. You pull out an awful lot of information right now. What a cagey character you would be. Boy, if you ever hear this old guy, he's standing outside the high school and he's looking at all these beautiful young girls walking out. He's standing there wise and old and old and very old. And he says, boy, if I was only 16 again and know what I know now. Yes, yes, you're in the same position as that old viper. You actually can look at these precious morsels, but you have a knowingness about it. Never discount it. You better pick up your full track knowingness. The only way you do this, by the way, just run mock-ups about not knowing and so forth, knowing and not knowing and so on. How do you mock up knowing and not knowing? Well, I'll have to tell you all about that in the second lecture tonight. Transposition of symbols to language. How do language, what does it become and what? All right. Knowingness then doesn't really depend upon data. And there is a basic knowingness that is you that exists without wavelength. Funny thing to say, but it's true. Their capability of knowingness is all at the same level, the amount of data which can absorb changes. A person can be very naive and way up tone scale. And then he becomes sadder and wiser. And for the first time in this universe, really, Homo sapiens has been able to take the knowledge gained and back out. That's very valuable. In other words, you don't have to keep on digging in. It may even be your track is sort of going according to plan. I mean, this might be the exit depot. You don't know. Might be. Maybe I don't tell you everything. Maybe this is all science fiction, I tell you, anyway. By the way, I hope it gets lots of publicity as such. Boy, it'll make you guys free for a long time. One day, one of you will get very ambitious and pick up 5 yellow cabs as they come down. You couldn't get a yellow cab, and you finally say, damn these yellow cabs. Instead of mocking up a yellow cab, you suddenly pick up the first yellow cab, and you get the second yellow cab, and the third yellow cab, and you put them up on top of one of the high buildings around. Turn their motors off so they don't skid and run off the top of the building and leave them there. People say, who did this? Well, we're going to issue a lot of little cards, and little cards say, you have abandoned your godliness. Good motto, abandon your godliness. You don't say what the godliness is, but everybody thinks they know what you're talking about, and you know darn well what you're talking about. It's true, too. All right. Then all of a sudden, why, it will become something else than
that. Actually, incredibility is the finest guise in the world for a secret. That's too incredible. Nobody believes it. How do you suppose this messed universe got itself covered up? At every stage you've been in, any other stage was too incredible. You see, that's that wind backflow. If you've got to believe, if it's enforced belief, there's also going to be inhibited belief. And when the guy really got downscale, he couldn't possibly get out because he had inhibited belief. He had to distrust. When he tried to believe, he'd distrust. You wonder why people down along that lower band of the scale can't believe in any God, why no God's safe in their hands. They can't believe. So get this action then. Let's get the quality of these things. You'll find all of these things delineated in your textbook. You'll find they do consist of a fairly good state of being. They also describe to some degree the quality of a mock-up. If you couldn't make a mock-up, a year from now, if you're not able to make a mock-up, senior to you, as you sit there, that can do more and act faster in your universe, I'll disown you. I think I'll disown you anyway. Now, let's then take a look at this chart of attitudes. And let's give you, right quick, in spite of all this persiflage, let's give you, right quick, rising scale processing. Rising scale processing. This is the use to which you put the chart of attitudes. And is a method of changing postulates, not a method of running flows. This is, in essence, the essence of postulate processing. Postulate processing is the process or any process which permits an individual to change his postulates. Except old engrams. You run out some old engram and of course you change the postulates in it. But this doesn't talk about that. This is willfully changing postulates. First thing you've got to do is get the person up to a point where they're flexible with their postulates and fast with them. You do this with mock-ups and so on. And one day, the guy can get almost perfect mock-ups. Almost perfect, but I keep running into this or that, or I got to change my mind about this, or I've got to do something else about that. Well, what he's doing is changing postulates. He'll find out that he starts to do something, he recognizes all of a sudden he can't do it, and he will just suddenly go brrr, and change this postulate and that postulate and so on, and wipe those postulates out and make a new postulate. And all of a sudden he'll say, oh, that's all right, yeah, I got the lights back up again now. Now she's doing the rumba. He had all these postulates about dancing, and he had this girl, and she went around with him. It was very embarrassing. Every time he went to a nightclub or something of the sort, this mock-up rumba would come along. He couldn't dance with her. She couldn't rumba, so you change that. How do you change that? You had to change his postulate that she couldn't rumba. The dancing was evil, that dancing should be religious. Yap, 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 yap. And he'll just change postulates. Brrr. That is the process of the thetan. The thetan simply creates by making postulates. He uncreates by changing postulates and unmaking postulates. There's this drill about starting, increasing, decreasing, and stopping thought chains is beneficial in assisting one's ability to make postulates and uncreate postulates. If you can't handle your thought flow, if you've got a stream of consciousness running, you're going to have a hard time with postulates. So what's rising scale processing? It is one of the phases of postulate processing which enables a preclear well before he is up tone. Oh, hell, this will work on a 6. It'll work on a 5 case. Is to shift his postulates. And he does this by rising scale, not by running flows. That's different. A flow is a flow in, a flow out, a flow in, a flow out. All right, let's just change postulates. Now, what do we do about postulates? Let's look at this list for the chart of attitudes. Now, we have here survive and dead. Now, what's that mean? Well, it means that just like this, we have survive is somewhere between 22 and 40. Of course, above 40, the idea of survival is just nonsense. How could anything immortal not survive. That's one of the grimmest tricks in the world. You see, you happen to be immortal and worried about surviving. It's a typical reverse flow trick of this universe. You're actually worried hour by hour and day by day about surviving, and you're immortal. All you object to is when you don't survive, why, you forget. Something takes away from you hard enough for you not to remember. And as a result, you get upset. And what you're really upset, not about surviving at all, but about knowing. You hate to be in a state of unknowingness. You knew you were there, but you know you're not supposed to know you were there. You know all about it. You take the Battle of Trafalgar, you know. You know how many men were aboard the ship and how many killed and wounded there were and how many dispatches were written up to send them up the river and all that sort of thing. And by the way, there's wonderful science fiction. There's wonderful science fiction. God help science fiction writers. God help them. Boy, do they key in. I think of poor old Paget. I'll use his pen name, Big Gag. Poor old Paget. He's a shaking wreck. He's a ruin. You guys know this fellow. You know his stories under a lot of other guises than Paget. And he's a ruin. He sits there at the typewriter and he types and he thinks he's disagreeing like mad with the Mesh Universe. He's running away from the Mesh Universe. He's writing escape literature. I picked up one of his stories recently and started reading the history of a ship which is very well known, extremely well known. And he's just varied its history. He hasn't varied a line. He actually is sitting there writing escape literature, and of course he's digging in deeper and deeper and deeper, and he's getting worse and worse. They have to take him in, and doctors will sometimes take and give him a course of B1 shots, and they'll give him 100 or 200 milligrams of B1 every couple hours to keep him alive. And he's that bad off. And then he goes back and he works a little bit harder and he works a little bit harder and he works a little bit harder. And all of a sudden, wham, B1, B1, rest, rest, sit down by the seashore, take it quiet, take it easy, take it easy. And then he says, well, I think I'll write some more of that escape literature. And zong, there he goes again. He's coughing. He can't stand the sight of a camera. I don't know how long that boy was on the track or how many spirals, but boy, he's sure writing ancient history. It's all dated up in the future, too. He'll date something up in the future. And then you get very careful that he doesn't date it. He actually uses actual dates. He's playing the very most wonderful game with himself of not to know. If you were to put any of these boys, by the way, on a machine, you'd get something fascinating. You get, now, all right, now let's talk about space. Space, obviously, is a very minor point in this universe. Don't think that it is major at all, because it is not major. And for most people, it is not even part of the track. Space opera is not part of the track at all for most people. It's only the degraded, the bums, the stiffs, the clips, the gyps, the McGees, the floaters, the flotsam and jetsam, the guy who's rammed around and fallen flat on his face and so on. That's space opera. God, these guys, I could tell you that story of that track. I don't think it could go into English. There are a lot of words in English that are missing. It's just too wild. And it's peculiar. It's a peculiar story, a very highly specialized story. The other track comes right straight down on subject of planets. And in some pre-clear's life, it's just fascinating. You find him leading this cozy little home life, and he's been in this cottage, and they were on that farm. And then he was in this city as a little minor tradesman and some other place why he drove a truck and so on. There's cities and things. Nothing shiny, pastoral, pretty, nothing to it. Some girl, about the only time you get a girl, you get a lot of girls that have been on the space opera track, too. They've been boys on the space opera track, or girls. God help them. Boy, are they a mess. They're really degenerate. They're walking around here trying to do a job of being normal. Of course, they're much smarter, much wiser. And actually, for anybody to have survived that track and still be in a body, it must mean they're awfully tough. That's the truth. Like, I suppose they put most of the guys who weren't tough are still sitting in cans someplace. But anyway,
this quiet pastoral scene, the girl, and the only time she ever saw a spaceman or anything like that, she'd heard about him. They'll show up on a meter. Well, now you take one of these space opera writers, if he's really been on that track, he won't write about it if he hasn't been. He just won't have the knack. That doesn't mean you couldn't be ingenious enough to invent the whole thing from one end to the other. It just means they don't. Also, they don't write science fiction if they haven't been solidly on that track. They'll write something else, fantasy, something. All right, put them on the machine. You'll say, all right, now let's take this last story you wrote, and it'll dive, and you say, what are you diving for? Didn't it sell? Yes, it sold. needle falling away. You say, well, now take the hero of this thing, fall. And you say, you know, that fellow's being affected by writing. Now let's take that detective story which you wrote. No motion of the needle at all. Well, didn't it sell? No, it didn't sell. Yeah, I got a reject on that. Yeah, that's bad. Very interesting. So you say, well, this guy must be all keyed in hallucinating. He just must have been driven mad by writing all these stories. So let's examine all these stories carefully. And what do you know? They start blowing his locks. Locks on what? Well, let's put him back on the machine again. And let's ask him, all right, now, have you ever been in a spaceship? Oh, wham! Oh, don't ask me questions like that, he says. You make me think I'm imagining things or something. He said, well, have you ever been in a spaceship? Well, gee. I get nervous. Well, how about hands? How about trying to get... how about blow-ups in space? I mean, anything like this and so on. Were you ever there? What was that year? What year were you a member of the Galactic Police Force Espionage Corps or something or other? Wham, wham, wham. You say, what story did you write about this? He'll tell you, Skylark, that's all. I don't know anything about his past history, E.E. Smith's. he'll say, well, it's such and such a year. Yeah, get a needle reaction. Now you say, how about the stories you've written about that? Tiny little needle reaction is keying out. Now let's take the Skylark, let's go over a little bit further and a little bit more, and this, oh boy. We're starting to get the big action on the actuality and no action on the story. And then you just turn it up, and not by slanting the questions or anything, you just turn it up, just try and get some kind of a charge on the stories. But you'll get charged right straight across the boards, and it was biographical or autobiographical. All of a sudden, this guy will start to reel, and he'll start to cough, and he'll say, you know, I feel a helmet. I'm sure it must be a helmet. My ears are ringing like mad. I can't understand it. My ears often ring when I'm writing. Come to think about it, they only ring when I'm writing about space stories, and I get that feeling right now. It's like a goldfish bowl or something closing down over my... Yeah, you keep your chin down in order to keep the earphones open. Oh, no! You say, well, now let go of it. Oh, I can't. What would happen if you let go of it? What would happen if you didn't have it? Oh, nothing. Needle, wham, wham. Of course, he's out in the middle of space. He'd spatter all over the landscape if he let go of it out there in a vacuum. Well, all right, now, what would happen if you took it off? I can't take it off. See, needle. You finally coax him out of this idea and so forth. You find he's got a cracked helmet on or something. He's practically dying. And you run him into all these incredible situations. He starts to perk up and he gets happier and he gets cheerfuler and he gets feeling better. And he gets to feeling better and better and better. And then he said, I just thought of some good space opera. But he says, I think I'll write a detective story. He loses interest in it. A lot of your bad science fiction is by boys who, they were just bad the whole track. But they weren't very bad. The guys who really write the good stuff and so forth, boy, were they horrible. What are you laughing about? Yeah. I never wrote any science fiction myself. People think I've written it. That's right. It doesn't classify as science fiction. There's one with stubborn. There's a story which you would be vastly amused about in this class. It was appeared in Astounding Stories many years ago, probably 1940. One was stubborn. It is a civilization which was... It isn't space opera, see? It's usually about civilizations, things like that. It was a story about a civilization which was buckling under the terrific agreement on the subject of Christian Science. It was just caving in on it, but there was one guy who didn't believe in Christian Science, and it's his fate. at the end of the story. It's called One Was Stubborn. Terrific application of what we're doing right this minute. It's fascinating. And you take, there was a story called Final Blackout. Actually, it was a political commentary and a character study of an officer. That's all it was. It's laid right here on Earth. And very short time into the future. A lot of these other things. Once in a great while, I'd write something that had to do with that. You take the UMS stories, the old Loch Methuselah stories and so forth. Straight off the record. No fiction to them, really. They're hopped up. That's about all. Now, here we got real death would be Thetan death, and it would lie down below minus 8 here. And you'd get Homo sapiens would be somewhere in the neighborhood. His death would be here at 0, 0. So let's take a look here. Dead, death, Homo sapiens. And let's find up here is alive. Now let's do a rising scale processing on the scale of survival death. You say this pretty clear. What's your idea of your chances of survival? Pretty clear, thinks it over for a minute. Well, answer this question yourself. What's your idea of your own chance of survival? Just face it bluntly and get what your current opinion is of your chance of survival. Take in all possible fields. What's your current opinion? All right, now take that opinion, whatever it was. And by the way, what was yours?
Forever.
Huh? Inevitable?
No, before Scientology was an awful long time, and now it's forever.
Oh, it is. Good. What was yours? Okay, what's yours? Is that what you got? Oh, hell, you people aren't. Don't need. I mean. Well, did anybody get... What was yours?
Well, I answered the question very good. You asked the question...
All right, very good. Your chances of survival are very good. How long?
I can't answer that question.
Ah, we've got a don't know survival. Very good, but a don't know. All right, let's take that very good, but I don't know, and let's see if we can't get a higher opinion on it. This sort of shifted up to a higher, better opinion on it. Well, get that other opinion, kind of hold it for a moment. Very good, but I really don't know. So a little bit better opinion.
Excellent, yeah.
All right, now let's get it from excellent up to a higher opinion.
Anything other than time.
Beingness.
Beingness.
Mm-hmm. There's a maybe on that somehow. Then there'd be two things. Your chance of survival is Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
Well, what's your opinion of your survival as Homo sapiens?
That's the very good, I guess.
Hmm? Not very good?
I say that is the very good.
Oh, that's the very good. How what about the other one? You don't know. Oh, that's the don't know. We've got the don't know, all right. Can you take that don't know and shift it any higher as a postulate?
Well, I don't quite get the question.
Could you shift it up to might be from just flatly don't know? Could you say, well, it might be able to survive, or might be something there to survive?
Well, I think might be would be below don't know to me is in the middle.
Oh, that's in the middle.
Yeah.
What's above don't know?
Above don't know is good.
Good.
Below don't know is possibly fairly probable. In other words, don't know is in the middle and sort of halfway in between.
All right. Well, can you get a better opinion on it?
I can get the concept of a better opinion.
Well, can you get a better opinion?
Or does the opinion have to have data?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
All right, so that's hanging up, and opinion can hang up, or condition can originate or generate for the lack of a datum. In other words, you can get randomity caused by a missing datum, or you can get a maybe caused by a missing datum. So here's a missing datum showing up preventing a postulate. You could go ahead and ask what he has to know and so forth. That's very good now. But when we ask for an upper shift of a postulate, let's get an upper shift on this one. Right and down here, wrong. And where are you on rightness? How right do you think you are? Generally right. We can do better than that. Let's get this postulate, this concept, better, generally right, and let's shift it up higher.
Well, it doesn't make any difference.
If you are right.
I mean, I'm right as far as I'm concerned. That's an important thing.
Uh-huh. Can you shift it higher than that? Good, 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 good. Can we get any higher than that?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, okay. All right. Now, actually, we could go through this chart of attitudes and just shift like that. You say, all right, what's your concept, how right you are? So you're looking for the right-wrong scale. The guy, whatever he gets... All right, let's get a higher concept of it. Let's get a better idea of it. What he says, what's a better idea? You kind of explain to him what's a better idea in your level. And how responsible are you? Let's get that. How responsible?
Hmm?
Horribly?
Fully.
You're fully responsible. Okay. How responsible are you? Fully responsible. Do you really feel responsible? How responsible are you for police? Okay, let's raise that concept about responsibility for police.
We shouldn't have to have
them. Mm-hmm. Let's raise that concept higher than that.
We won't need to have
them. Okay, let's see if we can get any higher on your responsibility for police.
There's no necessity for them.
There's no necessity for them. Good, let's get it higher than that. And so we go on up toward full responsibility on one subject, you see. And now we could take, how much of an effect do you think you are? You know, how much of an effect do you think of yourself as being?
An occasional effect.
An occasional effect. Let's see if we can boost that up.
Really?
Okay, let's get a higher idea of it.
One over infinity effect.
Does that really make you feel? Does it change any idea in you?
No.
Well, come on, let's change your basic concept on the subject of being an effect.
I need not be an effect. I'm not.
Aha, now we're getting a shift. I'm not an effect.
I guess the next thing is I am cause.
You're not reaching that, though, are you? How close are you coming to it? Okay, now that's one way of doing rising scale processing. You just explain to your pre-clear that you've got this scale. If the scale goes survive, dead, right, wrong, how right do you think you are? How responsible do you think you are? Or do you want to be? How much do you own? And how many people could you be if you had to be? And so on. You just go across the scale like that. Now, there's an entirely different way of doing this. And this is also rising scale, but you'd call that first rising scale... as a very gradient shift. That's very gradient rising scale, small step rising scale.